listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, flooding after Hurricane Harvey was off the charts. We'll talk with a UW-Madison researcher who geomapped Harvey and determined it was a 1,000-year flood event.
First, the legislature's budget committee passed a transportation funding package on Tuesday. Transportation funding was one of the biggest sticking points so far in budget negotiations. The budget was due July 1st.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, and he's with us now from the state capitol. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Veronica.
Well, Sean, what's in this transportation deal that the budget writing committee just passed?
They added a whole lot last night that we hadn't seen before, but I think what a lot of people are looking at is what's not in the transportation package.
So, okay, what's not in it?
You heard all year from Republican lawmakers, especially the Republican Assembly Speaker, that they wanted a long-term transportation funding fix. You knew there were a lot of Southeast Wisconsin Republicans that had some projects they wanted to prioritize, like the expansion of Interstate 94 west of Milwaukee. Certainly a controversial project, but something that Southeast Wisconsin Republicans and the business community wanted. So what this budget doesn't have, it doesn't have that long-term transportation funding fix. And that I-94 project west of Milwaukee, along with a few others, are also not in this budget.
And it sounds like there was some unusually frank admissions, at least from Republican John Nygren, that, yeah, this didn't quite hit all of the goals that maybe Republicans and others were looking for.
Yeah, so, I mean, Nygren was another one of those outspoken advocates saying we need to do something long-term. The state's transportation debt has been creeping up over the years to the point that after this budget, about 22 cents out of every dollar the state spends on transportation is going to go toward paying off debt service. I haven't seen an updated number on that since they passed this motion yesterday, but it's going to be in the ballpark of that. So one thing they did do is they reduced borrowing pretty significantly compared to what the state has done in recent budgets. They're going to borrow about $400 million in this budget, and that includes money they're borrowing in the Foxconn incentive package for I-94 south of Milwaukee between Milwaukee and Chicago. So $400 million is the lowest they've borrowed in more than a decade. But with less borrowing comes fewer projects. I mean, if they're not going to have a new source of revenue, significant new source of revenue from like the gas tax or a general vehicle registration fee or a fee on heavy trucks, which they didn't do, and they're not going to borrow as much, there's just less money to go around. So not only did you not move ahead with that project west of Milwaukee, they prohibited the state from building anything, using anything in this budget to construct the north leg of Milwaukee's Busy Zoo interchange. And then you figure the rest of that money, that $400 million in borrowing, just got to be spread a little thinner across the state because projects like I-3990 and others throughout the state are not getting any cheaper.
There was one new fee. It sounds like the hybrid vehicle tax.
There was, yeah. So what's going to happen is that in Wisconsin, there will be a new $100 per year fee on electric cars and a new $75 annual fee on hybrid vehicles. It's not going to generate a lot of money. In this budget, it's going to generate about $8 million for the state. So to just put that in some context, you look at the widening of Interstate 3990 between Madison and the Illinois border. That's like a $1.6 billion project, depending on how you score it. So that's not going to solve all the headaches, basically. But it was an area where Republicans, they might not have been comfortable raising the overall gas tax or the overall vehicle registration fee. They were okay raising it on electric cars and hybrids. They said those vehicles aren't paying their share now because they don't pay the gas tax like the rest of us do, or to the degree that the rest of us do. The flip side of that is they're usually very light vehicles and do much less damage to roads than, say, a heavy truck.
Right. And speaking of heavy trucks, it seems as though there's some changes there that Wisconsin will allow larger weights on these trucks.
Yeah, and that's been kind of the norm in Wisconsin, where year after year you see legislators who are willing to grant exemptions to the laws that law on heavy trucks. I mean, the general standing law is that a truck has to be a maximum of 80,000 pounds to be on Wisconsin's roads. But in this budget, you've got a few more exemptions for that. In a couple northern Wisconsin counties, if a truck is carrying timber products, then they could be more than twice that legal limit. They could get exemptions elsewhere in the state if they're carrying garbage and they exceed the legal limit. And agricultural vehicles that already are allowed to exceed the legal weight limit, the law that gives them that right was extended under what the Finance Committee passed in this transportation plan.
And Sean, how did lawmakers react to the deal?
Well, I mean, this is the issue that has been holding up the budget for more than 2 months. The budget deadline is officially June 30th. There's not a lot of major consequences if it doesn't pass by then, but that is when the old fiscal year ends and the new one, the new budget is supposed to be in place on July 1. So with transportation holding it up for months and so much arguing over transportation, I think there was a lot of focus put on this for good reason. And so you had Democrats like Senator Lena Taylor from Milwaukee essentially telling Republicans, you know, this wasn't really worth waiting for.
We've been waiting on y'all all summer. And this is what you came up with? F. Big F. That's what you get. Failure.
And that's where you heard Republicans like Representative John Nygren of Marinette, who co-chairs the budget committee, say, you know, they're not going to take a victory lap over this plan.
We're going to pass a responsible budget that lives within our means, but by no way are we solving our transportation funding challenge. And quite honestly, it's disappointing to me because we got elected to solve problems. We've solved a lot of them. We continue to solve them every day. Yet this is one that is left unsolved.
And so, I mean, it's kind of a case of deja vu. You heard Nygren say, you know, similar comments to that after previous budgets where they said that, you know we have transportation funding issues in this state. We have to deal with it. They haven't really done it again. You know, they did include a study of tolling in this budget, which, you know, you're tempted to say that sounds like a potentially significant step. It's a $2.5 million study of tolling, which would generate all sorts of revenue potentially if Wisconsin ever went down that road. But, you know, Wisconsin legislators approved a $1 million study of tolling in the last budget, and that wasn't enough to, you know, kind of nudge them over the edge on that issue. So that's not exactly going to fix the short-term woes here.
Right. So the big problem of transportation funding is on the shelf again for another year. There are some other things rolled into this, though. There's several provisions, Sean, to limit what local governments can do. What are the specifics of that?
Yeah, those were some of the surprises. And I think one of them, you know, looked a little out of place in a big transportation motion. And that was one that would limit the power of local governments to regulate quarries. So that'd be quarries for like sand and gravel that would be used, you know, as the raw products for road making was the justification given for putting that in the transportation budget. It would tie local governments' hands in a number of ways, from restricting what these quarries can do. There's also restrictions on spending public money on Milwaukee's streetcar. And that's not the first time that Republican lawmakers who run state government have said to Milwaukee city government what they can and can't do when it comes to public monies for that streetcar.
And Sean, switching focus again within this budget decision yesterday, there was also an incentive package for the tech manufacturer Foxconn. Also includes new language relating to legal challenges to Foxconn's operations. That's an interesting one. What's the story there?
Yeah, that was one we had not seen before. We know that the Foxconn package included about $3 billion in state incentives for Foxconn. A lot of that's going to be in the form of checks to Foxconn. Because they'll essentially have no tax burden should they locate here. We knew that there were a number of, grants of exemptions to environmental permits to Foxconn in this bill. This is something that was added yesterday, though, in the budget committee. It would say that in court cases or lawsuits involving Foxconn, appeals would go directly to the state Supreme Court. So instead of going through the appeals court, to the appeals court first and then moving on up to the state Supreme Court potentially, any decision handed down by a circuit court judge or a county judge would be appealed directly to the state Supreme Court. That Supreme Court is dominated by conservatives right now. There's a 5-2 conservative majority there. And I think, by most measures, a pretty business-friendly court. Another thing that would do is it would say that Anytime there is a decision handed down by a lower court judge and that decision is appealed, it would immediately be stayed. So, which means it would be blocked, basically. If a lower court judge issued a ruling, it could be appealed to the state Supreme Court, and it would be automatically blocked.
And Sean, just briefly, walk us through a couple of the reactions you heard.
Yeah, so one would be Republican Representative Mark Bourne of Beaver Dam, who said, you know, the state Supreme Court's the court of last resort anyway. Makes sense to put these cases there as quickly as possible.
Because they both have the ability then to have their day in court, which is really what the due process is about. And then either side not liking that first ruling can directly go to the court of last resort, save time, save money, get their final ruling, and move on with their lives.
And then you had Democratic Representative Katrina Shanklin of Stevens Point saying this is yet another way where Republicans are giving Foxconn, a private company, special treatment.
I feel like it's rigging the game, and it's a way to speed up a process to get a favorable decision in place at a time when, if anything, we need strict accountability and oversight.
And Katrina Shanklin there, Democrat, about this Foxconn change. And Sean, what's next?
So the budget committee's going to wrap up. They say they're going to wrap up work on the rest of the state budget today. You know, we already know they're not going to support Governor Walker's proposed income tax cuts. They're not going to support Governor Walker's proposed sales tax holiday for school supplies. They are going to support a new personal property tax cut, but that'd be for businesses and it cost about $74 million to state government. And they've already voted to lift restrictions on Wisconsin's special needs voucher program. So another way in which they're expanding vouchers in Wisconsin. What we don't know is what's in the, you know, the wrap-up motion, which is kind of the catch-all for every budget, where lawmakers pretty much, if they have any idea, any bill, any budget idea, gets lumped into that bill. And there's been some controversial stuff there in budgets passed.
Sean, thanks a lot for catching us up.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, joined us for an update on the latest action in the state legislature's budget committee, including the passage of a transportation budget. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Photographer Pedro Guerrero was born 100 years ago this month. At age 22, he became the favored photographer for the world's most famous architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. Dean Robbins has his story.
Pedro Guerrero spent most of his life in the Southwest and East Coast, but he's still a Wisconsin favorite thanks to his ties to Frank Lloyd Wright. Guerrero was Wright's chosen photographer, producing classic images of both the architect and his buildings. Even decades after Wright's death, Guerrero returned to Wisconsin often to regale local admirers with tales of his larger-than-life mentor. He loved the place so much he began spending summers here in the vicinity of Taliesin, Wright's dazzling headquarters in Spring Green. I went to see Guerrero speak at countless receptions in Wisconsin galleries, homes, and lecture halls. I never tired of his witty stories, especially the one about his fateful first meeting with Frank Lloyd Wright. Pedro was the son of a humble sign painter in Mesa, Arizona. In 1939, as a 22-year-old art school dropout, he got up the nerve to apply for a photography job with Wright in nearby Scottsdale, where the world's most famous architect was busy building his winter headquarters. Wright saw promise in Guerrero's portfolio of nudes and still lifes and hired the stunned young man on the spot. He put Guerrero to work chronicling the dramatic structures taking shape in the Arizona desert. After a few months of learning on the job, Pedro packed up his bedroll to accompany Wright back to Wisconsin. On the drive into Spring Green, he marveled over southwest Wisconsin's gentle hills and neat farmhouses. And then he saw Taliesin, a sandstone and cypress masterpiece nestled organically into the landscape. It was a photographer's dream, and Guerrero set about photographing the compound's buildings as if they were sculpture. Wright loved seeing his work through Guerrero's eyes and took him along to document other projects around Wisconsin. On these jaunts, the observant photographer collected stories he would tell for the rest of his life. Among his other eccentricities, Wright hated when clients dared to express their own tastes once they occupied his houses. He shamelessly rearranged their furniture and instructed Pedro to destroy any of their knickknacks that detracted from his pure artistic vision. eventually moved to the East Coast to work for magazines and other acclaimed artists, but he remained Wright's preferred photographer, making himself available for on-call projects until the master's death in 1959. That might have been the end of Pedro Guerrero's connection to Wisconsin. Beginning in the 1990s, however, his fame spread as one of Wright's key collaborators. The state rediscovered him, and he rediscovered us. He became a frequent visitor who served as a link to a long-gone genius. Pedro died in 2012 at 95, leaving his Wisconsin friends heartbroken. He's buried here in his adopted state in the little cemetery across the road from Taliesin. Wright was buried there too. It's fitting that his gravestone and Guerrero's will spend eternity side by side.
Dean Robbins is a writer in Madison. His most recent book is Margaret and the Moon. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now some climatologists are saying Hurricane Harvey was the heaviest rainfall in American history. It dumped almost 52 inches on parts of southeast Texas last month. Researchers at UW-Madison Space Science and Engineering Center crunched the numbers and concluded that Harvey was a 1,000-year flood event.
Shane Hubbard is an associate researcher in the center's Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Shane, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, put this in perspective for us. What does it mean when we say this was one in a 1,000-year flooding?
Well, we can also talk about this, about sort of the percent annual chance. And so that's a 0.1% annual chance of having an event like that in any given year. Mm-hmm. So we also, you can flip that around and say it's a 99.9% chance of not having it in a given year. So it's a very rare event.
And as I understand probability, that doesn't mean we've got 1,000 years till the next one. That we still have, I mean, it could happen next year.
You could have them in back-to-back years. I mean, you could have these things, although these are very rare events, you know, so, you know, but you might see a 100-year or 1% annual chance in back-to-back years. Those things do happen.
So. At what point do we start to say, wow, this is a bigger than a 1 in 1,000-year chance of this happening? It's becoming more probable.
More probable. Well, let's put it in perspective, I guess. If we think about what happened in Texas and move that to Wisconsin, if you drew a line from just west of Eau Claire to the border all the way to Green Bay, south to the Illinois border, that entire area in Texas would have been covered in 20 inches of rain or more. Mm-hmm. If you go from Vernon County to Ozaukee County and down, 30 inches or more. Columbia, Dane, Sauk, and Iowa counties would have had 40 inches of rain or more. So it was just a massive rainfall amount on a massive scale. So we're talking about probabilities that are very, very low.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, as one of the reasons we try to, I guess, rate these is to know, are things getting worse either naturally or because of climate change? How do we assess that?
So let me take that into two parts.
Sure.
First of all, we want to rate these things because it gives communities the ability to plan for future development, future construction, stormwater, where they're going to build. They need a value. They need to understand how much water it takes to do these things, and they need to start. Now, a community could say, well, you know, we think climate change is going to alter that value. And instead of planning for the 1% or 100-year storm event, we're going to go for the 500-year. But they need a baseline to plan for. Now, when we think about if these are getting more frequent, we look at research, and research is telling us that for some rainfall events, we're finding that those durations are shorter, and we're getting more rainfall out of those. So parts of the country are noticing a change in how we receive our rainfall.
And you've talked about how communities can plan, and the old way, I guess, is let's build those levees a little bit bigger. There are other ways of thinking about that now. What are communities looking at?
Oh, communities look at elevating structures, keeping structures out of the floodplain. There are things that you can do in your home also to keep the floodwaters out. Flood-resistant materials, again, building the foundation higher. There's also flood walls and temporary structures you can put in to keep the water away.
Now, we were hoping to be talking to you about one hurricane. Unfortunately, now we've got Hurricane Irma passing by Puerto Rico, I guess, this evening. And you've studied flood impacts in Puerto Rico, among other places. What are they watching for there?
Yeah, the northern coastline of Puerto Rico has quite a lot of flooding potential. There's a lot of very low-lying areas. The stormwater systems are old and they're inadequate. There's a number of places, especially in San Juan, that only an inch of rain can produce 4 feet of flooding. So it's a tremendously high flood vulnerable area. I've got friends that have been texting me pictures and kind of communicating what they're seeing. They're seeing right now about 70 mile per hour winds and gusts that are a little bit higher.
And we were talking just before we came on the air. Irma's looking pretty strong.
Yeah, just recently, and within the last 2 hours, there was a reading of 195 miles per hour measured at the surface. Now, it's possible that reading doesn't hold, but if it does hold at 195, it would be the strongest hurricane in terms of wind speed ever in the Atlantic, Caribbean, or Gulf of Mexico, and would be one of the strongest anywhere in the globe.
And we're at another milestone. You were saying three hurricanes potentially?
Yeah, so there was a discussion earlier, but at the 5 p.m. Release that we may have three hurricanes in the Atlantic all at one time, one in the Gulf, and then two out in the Atlantic with Irma and Jose out there in the Atlantic.
That's not something we see every year.
Happily. Well, if you're going to see it, I think you're going to see it right about now. I mean, this is the peak of the hurricane season around September 10th, September 11th. So if you're going to have multiple tropical systems or multiple hurricanes, we generally would find that about right now.
Now, on the mainland United States, we're not expected, as I understand it, to see flooding like we saw in Houston. The storm's not going to park over Miami. So what are you watching for with flooding if this hits Florida?
Well, there's going to be a tremendous amount of rainfall. The one thing about Irma is it's been maintaining a pretty swift pace. The flooding, though, is going to be coming from the storm surge. When you're talking about Category 4 and Category 5 hurricanes making landfall in the United States, you're going to be really concerned about 18-foot, 20-foot, 25-foot wow. storm surges along that coastline. So the flooding is going to be rainfall on top of that storm surge.
Shane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Shane Hubbard, Associate Researcher, UW-Madison Space Science and Engineering Center. He's been analyzing flooding from Hurricane Harvey and other events. Now it's back to school season, and if you're the parent of a 3 or 4 year old, there's a good chance you've enrolled them in a pre-kindergarten or pre-K program. The popularity of these early childhood education programs has grown throughout the years, alongside research that has shown the benefits these programs can have on young minds. When it comes to pre-K, not all programs are created equal.
That's according to our next guest, who says that she was surprised by the variability she saw across pre-K classrooms in the United States.
And she says those differences in quality can make a big difference in educational outcomes.
Suzanne Buford is a writer with a background in child development and education and the author of the book, The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children. Suzanne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So early on in your book, you write that early childhood education is at a crossroads in America. How so?
We are at a point in our history where we have more research than ever before showing the benefits of early childhood education. And as a result of that, we also have more funding and public support for early childhood programs than ever before, which is a great trend and something that is a boon both to children and to their families and communities. But at the same time, I have a fear that we are rushing to scale up these programs so quickly that we're not paying attention to what we're doing in those programs and whether the practices are high quality for children. So this is a really important moment to make sure that we get pre-K right, both for the children in the programs and also for the policies. What I would hate to see happen is for us to look back in 5 years or 10 years and say, oh, we tried pre-K, we funded it, it didn't work. Let's move on to something else. When the truth is that we know it can work if you do it well.
Because you're saying not all pre-K programs are created equal. There's ones, and you profile several in your book, some of them are really good at being effective and helping the children grow and learn and invest them in their learning, and other programs aren't doing the job quite as well.
That's right. There's a very wide range of quality across the country, sometimes even within the same city or the same school district.
And can you tell us about, for instance, a school in Boston? You open your book there with one of the top programs in the country. What is it that sets that one apart, the Elliott program?
The Boston Public Schools run a pre-K program. It's called K-1 in Boston, but it's the same thing as pre-K, that is a national model for other districts because children in that program do so well, and they continue to go on and do better in school than their peers up until at least third grade, and perhaps longer. They're continuing to be tracked right now in a research study. The Elliott is one of the schools in Boston that I had the opportunity to spend time in. And what I learned from spending time with the teachers and the students, and I also went to teacher trainings and professional development sessions, what I learned is that good pre-K programs like the ones in Boston teach young children how to be learners. They get them curious and excited about learning, for example, about how things work and how to find answers to problems. And in Boston, they use a curriculum that was created by the district specifically geared towards the way that young children learn. So they don't just ask kids to memorize the names of shapes, but they play really interesting games that help children understand what makes something a triangle. They don't regurgitate vocabulary words, but they play around with rhymes and they spend a lot of time with books. Learning to be a learner also means learning how to be part of a group and follow the routines and expectations of a classroom. So the teachers that I saw in Boston and in other model programs do a really good job of helping kids develop those skills. They don't focus on control or punishment. They teach what researchers call self-regulation. And that means giving kids the strategies and skills that they need to manage frustration, wait their turn, work out conflicts, and do all of those things on their own so that they know how to do those things when they get to kindergarten and beyond, and they're ready to be successful in school for the rest of their lives.
And you mentioned the benefits for pre-K when it's done right, when it's the kind of program you describe. What are those benefits?
There are a range of academic, social, and emotional benefits for children that last well into the school years, and some of the earliest model programs, which date back to the 1960s, have found that children who went to high-quality preschool programs are actually doing much better in adulthood. They are earning more money, they're less likely to be on public assistance, they're less likely to be incarcerated. So we now have data showing that those kinds of benefits for kids pay off for society in the long run, and that there's a return on investment probably somewhere between $3 and $8 saved in the long run for every dollar invested in early childhood education.
And how invested would you say the United States has been in pre-K education, maybe as compared to what you see in other developed countries?
Our commitment to early childhood education has been very spotty, and we as a country rank 28th out of 38 industrialized countries in our investment in early childhood education. That has been changing over the last decade or two so that we have far more investment and support than we used to have. We now have about 1.5 million children who are enrolled in publicly funded pre-K programs, but that's only about a third of four-year-olds in the U.S. and probably something around the order of 5% of three-year-olds. And the National Institute for Early Education Research recently estimated that if we continue to grow these programs at the rate we are now, it would take 50 years to serve all children. Now, that looks very different in some communities and in some states than others. I know that in Wisconsin, you have longstanding legislation that funds early education programs. So for families, it's a little bit arbitrary, and it has a lot to do with where you happen to live.
We're talking right now with Suzanne Bouffard, the author of The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children, looking at the successes of pre-education in America and how they can be improved upon. And one-third, you said, of children.
About one-third of children are in publicly funded pre-K programs, four-year-olds. About 66-67% of four-year-olds are in some sort of program, whether it's publicly funded or paid for by their families.
Well, what do we know about access? Do the children who may be facing other hurdles in life, maybe it's an economic hurdle in their family, maybe it's something else going on, structural obstacles, are they getting the same access to early education that that some of the other kids are enjoying?
We know that for sure the most affluent children have the most access. And that's problematic because the kids who are in most need of the support to get a good start in school are less likely to get it. Now, that being said, we have had some federal funding for children from low-income families and poor families since the 1960s. And a lot of people may have heard of Head Start, which is one of the longest-standing early childhood programs in this country. It's been a real help in terms of getting young children access. In many communities, it does not serve all children who are eligible because there are not enough spots, but it's been a good start. However, since the 1970s and 1980s, we've seen middle-class families really get squeezed when it comes to early education. As any parent knows, these programs can be very expensive, especially if you need not only a preschool experience, but also a childcare experience for if you have a two-parent family where both parents work or a single-parent family where that parent is working. So we know that those families are really struggling, and many people are making very difficult choices about work and family in order to make the balance sheet work. New York City, in the last few years, has created a universal program that's serving about 70,000 four-year-olds, which is pretty mind-blowing. And in their first round of research, they found that about 10% of the parents that they surveyed said that they were able to actually enter the workforce or increase their hours in the workforce because of this public program.
And seven states, you say, do not have pre-K programs. Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, among them. What's happening in those states, and what do we see about educational outcomes in states that don't have pre-K programs?
In those states, we think that one of the reasons that there hasn't been a public commitment to funding is because those are states that have a strong tradition of local control and of autonomy for families. There has, for a long time, been some concern among certain segments of the population that providing early childhood education is somehow taking the responsibility of parenting and child raising away from families and putting it in the hands of the state. That's not the case. When you go into model pre-K programs, you see that they actually work well with families, and they collaborate so that there is consistency between home and school. Teachers can teach parents a lot about how to promote learning, how to manage behavior issues, and families, of course, provide incredibly valuable information to teachers about what their children's needs and strengths are, because parents know their children better than anyone else. We also see that there are certain benefits to being in a classroom environment that children simply can't develop at home. And as many parents know, children will often act differently, sometimes for worse, but often for better, when they're not in the company of their parents. And there are also situations that arise in a classroom, particularly social situations, that just simply don't happen in other contexts. And so it's really good for kids to have the experience of learning how to manage those social situations and how to follow the expectations of a classroom before they get to kindergarten, when the stakes are low and when they're in an environment that is specifically designed to help them get ready.
Now, we were talking earlier about the programs that work that are having an effect on the outcomes for kids far down the road. And a big part of that picture is the educator, and you need a well-trained educator to pull off a good pre-K program. Can you talk a little bit about how important the role of the teacher, the educator, is?
The teachers are crucial. That's where the rubber hits the road of early education. So much of the learning process happens in the interaction between the child and the adult. So we know that good teachers do things like they get down on the child's level and really look in his or her face. They ask them open-ended questions. They engage them in rich conversations. And a big part of that relationship is about curiosity. And I think there are two parts to this. First of all, good teachers help children learn to be curious about the world around them. So they find teachable moments, they see what the child is interested in, and they do things like use new vocabulary in the context of the daily life or in the context of the kinds of things that the child likes to do. But the other piece that we sometimes lose track of is that good teachers are also curious themselves. In the book, I talk about children as being beautiful little puzzles. And I use that phrase because teachers who are really good with young children look at them as they want to understand why children do what they do. And so rather than imposing a specific curriculum or a specific behavior expectation on them, they stop and reflect. Why is this child having trouble with this skill? Or why is this child always acting out at a certain time during the day? They're like constant problem solvers. And that is really good for kids learning, and it also models for kids how to become problem solvers themselves, which is really what we want them to do throughout their education. We want them to learn how to be good thinkers and how to solve problems.
Right now we're talking with Suzanne Bouffard, the author of The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children, looking at the success of pre-K education in the United States and how high-quality programs can be made more accessible to parents everywhere.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent of a pre-K student? What do you see in the classroom that you like that you think could be improved? Did you have to work to get your son or daughter into the program of your choice? Do you think that pre-K is a good idea in general? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with Suzanne Bouffard, the author of The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten, and the Future of Our Children. She says that early childhood education is at a crossroads in the United States, and there's a lot more that we can do to make high-quality pre-K programs available to everyone.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a kid go through this kind of pre-K program? Do you think it made a difference? Is it a good idea to make it more available for everyone? And if you work in early childhood education, we'd also love to hear from you. What goes into making your program a success? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Suzanne, we were just talking about the role of the educator, and a 2016 report from the Departments of Education and Health and Human Services put a spotlight on the early childhood educator pay gap. According to that report, a preschool teacher's median salary in 2015 was just over $28,000. Now compare that to the median kindergarten teacher salary in 2015. That was just over $51,000. There's a pretty big gap there. Where do you begin to try to change that, and how important is it?
There is a really big gap there. And one of the things that surprised me most in researching this book was discovering that about half of early childhood educators in this country are eligible for public assistance programs because they make so little money. I think part of the problem is a lack of recognition about how skilled early childhood educators have to be. There has historically been this feeling that, well, they're just babysitting. Anybody who has children and who knows about children can do that. But the more we know about children's brains and the way they learn, the more we realize that teachers have to be very thoughtful and be constantly building the kinds of skills we've been talking about, the self-regulation skills, the learning skills, whether it's in geometry or helping a child build new vocabulary and think about the sounds that letters make. Those are all very difficult tasks. And if you think about how challenging it can be when your own children are having a tough day, think about being in a classroom with 10 or 15 children, more than one of whom is probably having a tough day at any given point. It's an incredibly difficult and incredibly stressful job. Now, you add to that the financial stresses of low income and also poor working conditions, and we have a population of teachers that's under an enormous amount of stress. Unfortunately, we have seen that the teachers who are paid the least are also in the most stressful environments, which means that they, in many cases, don't have breaks during the day. They don't have any scheduled planning time, so they have to do all their planning on nights and weekends. Sometimes they don't have a lot of resources like special educators or people who can help with children who have developmental delays. So all those kinds of stresses are weighing on teachers, and research is starting to show us that that's not only bad for teachers, it's also bad for kids. The more likely that teachers are to be stressed and in some cases depressed, that wears on children as well, and it affects the quality of the relationships between teachers and children. So we really need to make this a national priority so that we can attract the best and brightest teachers into early childhood, and we can retain them and support them so that they can make a career out of it.
Now, looking at changes, funding down the road, we have a new administration in the White House. We have a new Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. What have we heard from Secretary DeVos and from President Trump that might signal what their approach would be to supporting and to funding pre-K?
So far, we have heard very little about early education, so the jury is still out on that. I think it would be reasonable to expect that if they make any moves in the early childhood landscape, they would be focused on vouchers and choice, because we have seen a focus on those things in the K-12 area. Now, that being said, there are some existing voucher programs throughout the country that particularly low-income families can use to find early education programs for their children. I do, however, worry about focusing exclusively on voucher programs, because although that can increase access, it doesn't necessarily increase quality. And we're realizing more and more from research that children do well not just if they're in any program, but if they're in a quality program. And one of the issues with a market-based approach, it can have some benefits, but if we're relying on the market to sort out the good programs from the poor programs, then we're in danger of having some children go through the bad programs before they get weeded out.
We keep talking about the good programs and the bad programs. If you're a parent, how do you know? How do you figure out if you're getting your kid into a good program?
It can be very tricky, and that was the main reason that I decided to write The Most Important Year, because I saw as a parent, as I looked around when I was touring preschools for my own children, I realized how confusing it was, and I realized that many families were kind of caught up in things that were easy to see but weren't necessarily the most important things. So, for example, it can be easy to get caught up in the physical environment of a classroom and look for a place where there's like a lot of brightly colored posters on the walls and a really nicely manicured lawn and those kinds of things. And those things are actually not as important for children as what's happening in classrooms. So the kinds of things that families should look for are teachers who are nurturing and supportive of children. They give children guidance about what to do instead of constantly telling them what not to do. They are always finding learning opportunities and setting up activities that give children new things to think about. So a classroom should have plenty of resources and materials for children, and the activities should be changing, and the adults should be talking to kids about what they're learning from the activities. Certainly you want to find a place that's clean and safe, but there are other pieces to look for too. So for example, it's very important for young children to have a consistent routine. So it's a good sign if you're in a classroom where there's a routine posted, maybe with pictures, since young children typically can't read, that shows kids what to expect from the day. The opposite of that is if you're in a classroom that feels really chaotic, and either there's a lot of running around and kids are not able to manage their bodies, or if the teacher doesn't really seem to know what's happening from one day to the next and is just kind of flying by the seat of her pants, that's a red flag. And the last piece I will say is that, as we've talked about, teachers are really the most crucial part of a quality classroom. And you can get a sense from watching teachers how they feel about their jobs. Do they seem to be delighted by the children? And do they seem to be happy to be there? That's a good sign. If teachers are rolling their eyes and they're sighing at children and they're yelling at children, that's not a good sign. And it may be a sign that the center is not supporting the teachers the way that they could be. And it's okay to ask the directors of the program about their policies with teachers. Do they get time off? Do they get paid professional development time? Those things will also give you clues about how well the teachers are treated.
Suzanne, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for talking about this issue.
That was Suzanne Bouffard, a writer with a background in child development and education, and she's the author of the book, The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children.